So what are you doing back?
Well, I sat back and thought about the things we used to do. It really meant a lot to me. You mean a lot to me.
I really mean that much to you?
Girl, you know it's true.
Welcome to the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. And here we are, episode 53 of the SAFTAcast, as you just heard, and I will now repeat for you. My name is Scott C. Welcome to the program. Memorial Day, coming up in just a few days, unless you're listening to us in the future, beyond a few days, in which case it has passed. But as you are probably aware, here in the United States, Memorial Day is the unofficial kickoff of summer. So I consider this our unofficial summer kickoff episode, and it's a good one full of summer thoughts. But I know that summer isn't just a time for relaxing or enjoying good weather or what have you. It's also a busy time, and it is definitely busy for the folks at the Sundress Academy for the Arts. So let me update you on a couple of things happening with them in the very near future. If you're listening to this on its release date before Memorial Day weekend, then you're probably aware of the Poetry Retreat. If you're listening to us in the future, the Poetry Retreat, it was awesome. So I'm going to move ahead and tell you about a couple big events happening at Firefly Farms and the Sundress Academy for the Arts in the month of June. Let us move ahead. I've mentioned Outspoken before here on the program, especially during the spring months here as we get solicitations and we work with writers, editors, and publishers to create and craft the annual Outspoken event. Well, the dates of the performance have been set. The Outspoken 2016 event happens on June 25th, 2016 at 8 p.m. at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Bearden, Tennessee. It is going to be a night truly worth visiting. Now, if you're not familiar with Outspoken, you're just tuning in, maybe you've just recently discovered us, let me tell you what Outspoken is. It is a collaborative effort from the members of the Sundress Academy for the Arts, as well as Sundress Publications, in an effort for LGBTQIA+ persons from all walks of life, all areas of the country, not just the South, to talk about their experiences, about their sexuality, about their lives, and give voice and performance space to those stories that desperately need to be told. I encourage you to check this out. Again, Outspoken 2016 is June 25th at 8 p.m. at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Bearden, Tennessee. For information about the event, including details, ticket prices, and much, much more, you can visit Sundress Academy for the Arts. That is one word, sundressacademyforthearts.com, and click on Programs and Events. Before you run into the Outspoken project, though, you'll also see we don't just do a poetry retreat every summer. We also do a fiction retreat, and this year's fiction retreat is definitely happening on June 10th through the 12th. It is a weekend where if you are a fiction writer or someone interested in fiction writing, you can gather with like-minded individuals, including published authors, editors, and publishers, and talk to them about how to improve your writing, learn a few new tricks, workshop some new pieces, generate some new ideas, all in the beauty of Firefly Farms in Knoxville, Tennessee. Full of animals, flora, fauna, and great food, great company. I've been to them in the past. I've spoken about that, and they are truly excellent. I was at the fiction one last year, the poetry one before that. I cannot speak high enough about these events. And this one, as I said, is June 10th through the 12th, 2016. Camping, storytelling, much, much more. And two very special guests at this one, Sarah Gerkensmeyer and Emily Capitini, are going to be on hand to help you with your writing and improve it and much more. Just like with Outspoken, for information, ticket prices, and much, much more, you can visit Sundress Academy for the Arts, click on Program and Events, and you will see everything you need to see right there. But one little catch, though. Space is limited for the fiction retreat, and spaces fill up fast for this. But maybe fiction isn't your thing. Maybe you dig poetry, and you're sad that you missed the SAFTA Poetry Retreat 2016. There are many opportunities out there, and one of them is Poet Camp, which just happens to be run by today's guest, Sarah Ann Wynn. You can find information about that at poetrycamp.com and learn more about that. And in the course of today's episode, we do touch on that, as well as our thoughts on summer camping in general, including what we loved and didn't love about those days, as well as other summer moments of our lives. We talk a bit about our summer plans this year. It's a summer-filled episode, but not completely. We also touch on our love of dogs, our mystification at growing older, and what makes the Midwest such an inviting place to visit, if not live. That's all coming at you in just a moment or two, but first, get a load of the theme song. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Eh, it's that time of the year, summer, and for us academics, it's like, oh, I got so much I can do. I've got so much time, and then you do nothing.
Yeah, I was thinking you meant like that rainy time, but I forget you're in a different state.
Don't kid yourself. Nothing but torrential thunderstorms the last 2 days down here.
Oh, geez. I'd almost settle for that because it's nice and dramatic. This is just like drizzly, like pouty kind of rain.
You're up in Virginia, though, right?
Yeah, near DC, nearish DC, like 45-ish minutes by train.
Is it cold drizzle or like warm at least?
It's chilly. It's just between everything, like unsettling kind of weather. You can't get comfortable.
So England, then?
Yeah, I think this is pretty much probably what England is. My husband and I are heading to Ireland in July, and I think it's probably going to be exactly like this, the weather.
Why are you going to Ireland?
The Gerard Manley Hopkins Festival is there, and they invited people who are in the anthology to participate, and so I'm going to be a reader.
Kick ass!
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Have you ever been to Ireland before?
95. I was with a touring choir in my undergraduate, and we went to Ireland, England, Germany, and Poland. England was only a day. Ireland and Germany and Poland were a week apiece, and we stayed with families, and they shuffled us around. But that was Northern Ireland, and it was in the time when things were really in upheaval, like in a lot of turmoil. So for instance, our car was searched several times and our bus and our luggage were searched and we were stopped by people with guns. And our tour director told us under no circumstances were we were to respond to them with a joke when they asked us what we were doing there.
Did anyone make a joke?
No, but someone actually did get held up at the airport. He had not filled out proper paperwork. He'd immigrated from Russia to the U.S. and then gone on tour with the choir. And so he actually got sent back to the U.S.
Ooh, that's not cool.
No.
So of the three places in Ireland, Germany, and Poland, you said, which one did you enjoy the most?
Oh, Poland, hands down. I'd go back there in a heartbeat.
What was so cool about Poland?
It just was so untouched. It was the way that you would imagine fairy tales to be. This is before tourism really kicked off there and kind of when Eastern Europe was in a depressed time. And so the cities really felt like we were the only English speakers and you felt so immersed in their culture that it just felt magical. I loved it.
If given the chance, then you'd jump on a plane right back there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When you go to Ireland this summer, are you going to Southern Ireland this time or where specifically are you going?
We're staying in Dublin and the festival is in Newgate, but I think I'm only going to spend like 1 or 2 days at the festival because there are so many things I want to see. So I think we're just basically going to, you know, throw a dart at the map and tour all around. We're renting a car in Ireland, so we'll get to go everywhere.
What are you specifically looking to do when you're in Ireland?
Well, number one on my list is the Book of Kells. I really, really want to see it. I recently had seen that movie, the Book of Kells, and it just enchanted me. I loved it. So I really want to see the artwork that the monks did on that. And then I want to see some ruins, and I want to see some churches, and I want to go to their modern art museum. So I have a list.
Now the question is, does your husband also have a list, and do they line up?
He enjoys sitting in cafes and watching people come and go. So I think what's going to happen is I'll jaunt all over. And as soon as he gets sick of me, I'll drop him off at a cafe or something. And then I'll continue to jaunt without him.
And then just meet up later.
Yeah.
Works.
But he likes cities way more than I do too. So he'll actually enjoy just kind of walking the streets, where I want to be in the countryside and beyond the museums. I do want to see museums in the city, but I don't want to, you know, experience metro life there.
Now that brings up an interesting question. Were you raised in the city or raised in the country?
The suburbs, but I was raised in Akron, Ohio, and or near Akron, Ohio, in a small community called the Portage Lakes. And it just was very peaceful. It was not at all like you would imagine. Even suburban life here is so different from suburban life there. I compare it way more to the country. For instance, my graduating class, including the vocational tech students, was 83 kids. We were a small school in a small community, and I really liked it.
Mine was about 130, 140 maybe.
Is that including the VOTEC?
No, we didn't have VOTEC to our school, but around 130, around 140, I'd say. Maybe 150? I don't know. But I kind of know what you're talking about a little bit. When you say, though, very different from suburbs you live in now, what's the difference?
Oh, this is urban sprawl, where that was really just small community. This is like people rushing to work and rushing home from work and crammed together and just living right on top of each other. And I'm not, I've lived here since 96. So you would think I would have gotten used to it by now, but it's just not, it's not the same. So I've kind of, ever since we moved south of where I had initially moved down here to work, and we're more in the historic part of Manassas or close to Manassas, Virginia. And so it's a little bit different, feels a lot more like home. And so I'm finally resolved to be a Northern Virginian, where for a long time when people would ask where I was from, even though I hadn't lived for, you know, 15 years in Ohio, I would say I'm from Ohio.
I don't know if you ever lose that, though. I mean, I live in Florida and I've lived in Mississippi for many years now, just, you know, away. But I still call myself a New Yorker.
Oh.
When people ask, I don't know. It's just the mentality. I live in South Florida, yet I still have that attitude of, if I can quote Glove and Boots, you want to watch a 2-hour movie with me, you're done in 90 minutes.
That makes sense for a New Yorker. That's very similar to the DC feeling. I'm just not a careery in the way a lot of people who live in this area are. And I just, it's a shift, a mentality shift.
Is it kind of like the difference of like a suburb that has lawns and everything versus a suburb that has townhouses?
Yeah, exactly. Or a suburb that has stop signs versus a suburb that has speed traps and streetlights.
Like gated community versus real suburbs.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but Akron was just very, I mean, not Akron, Coventry in particular, that was my little township, was just very peaceful. And it still is. When I go home, the changes are much slower coming, where down here you blink and there's a brand new stoplight, or you blink and there goes up another townhouse complex. So change is the difference, I guess.
And your husband is more of a city person. Was he raised in the city or was he also in a country?
He really feels that he's from West Virginia. I think it's just where your heart is most comfortable, because he was born in Florida. He spent some time in Iowa. But when you ask where he's from West Virginia. And that's where he went to grade school and middle school and high school, and eventually moved away from there. But he was from a small community too. I think he just fell in love with the city. I think in a way that I haven't.
Some people are that way. I grew up in the suburbs and I prefer being in the urban environment rather than the country.
I think it's just a preference. It's a taste.
I think it is. Really, that's what it boils down to. Just a taste. Yeah. I get kind of creeped out by having my houses like 2 miles away from each other.
You mean like it's too far apart? You want to be close to your neighbor?
Even though I don't care about my neighbors and they don't care about me, you know, I don't care. I don't want to know them, but I'm more comfortable in an environment like that where there's more people.
Oh, we'll see. One of our criteria when we were looking at houses, I told my husband that I didn't want to be able to ask our neighbors who are grilling for a hot dog across the fence. Like, because you can often just like be that close that you feel like you're eating with them.
Okay, yeah, but I also, just in case something happens, I'd like to have somebody nearby, you know?
I guess I just have feeling that nothing's going to happen. Or just leave me. Whatever happens. Let the cat eat my face off. I'm okay.
I'm gonna go out on a limb here and say you're more optimistic about things than I am.
Yes, I am. I'm an optimist.
I blame upstate New York for that. My hometown breeds fatalism.
Upstate New York breeds fatalism?
Oh yeah. I'm from a town that is ranked as the most depressed city in all of America and the city with least hope.
I didn't know that was something you could like quantify.
Apparently it is, and apparently we ranked number one back in like 2013 in a survey.
Oh my gosh. Okay,
So,
well then you've got a reason for it.
oh yeah, I don't buy greeting cards because what's the point? Well, my
Exactly.
attitude.
That's not really a Hallmark sentiment. What's the point? We're all going to die anyway.
I want to make my own line of greeting cards based on that.
Fatalist press.
Condolences on the loss of your family member. If it's any consolation, you too will be forgotten about within 3 generations of human existence.
Probably sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it. Boy, that is a New Yorker, even state attitude. I can kind of see that.
I can't get it out of my blood, you know, no matter where I go. I'm always going
Yeah,
to New
I
York.
guess not.
Anyway, enough about me. So, other than Ireland, do you have any other summer plans, really? Or is it just kind of a time to relax and catch up on small stuff?
Well, I'm headed to Chicago even before Ireland for a reading in at the Women Made Gallery. It's a science and technology and math reading, and I'm all excited about that because I get to read with Donna Boyer and Stacey Balkin and a couple of other people whose work I really admire. So I'm excited about that, and I'm going to visit some friends and see some museums there too. And like I said, Dave's family's in the Midwest and my family's in the Midwest, so we'll spend some time with them. But other than that, I think in August I'm going to or hoping to go to Vermont to kind of scope out some poet camp stuff to get some real good ideas for places to take people and, hang out with my best friends up there. So that'll be fun. But other than that, mostly just writing and low key kinds of stuff.
Science, technology, and STEM fields and poetry?
Yeah, that's the Women Made Gallery hosts a literary series, and they always have a theme. And in the past, of course, they've been more or somewhat ekphrastic based because that's responding to visual arts. But I think that they're starting to branch out into other inspirations. And so I had sent them some hybrid pieces that I did that were kind of based on my. I'm a former librarian, so my reading in the science field and combining that with some family history, and they picked it up. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Neat.
Yeah, I really love traveling to do readings, and actually, Chicago in particular. The last time I was there was for a different reading for the Cultural Arts Center, and I really like that one. So I love the Midwest, even though
Why
Chicago is a city.
do you love the Midwest so much?
People are just really friendly. I think it's not necessarily that the pace is different because it's not. Chicago is as much a blustery kind of city as DC is, but the people's attitudes are completely or feel completely different. They're just very warm. And I think because my family is entirely from Ohio and West Virginia, and Ohio associates itself with the Midwest, I think it just feels like home to me, even extending west from Ohio.
Makes sense. I can't get away from the East Coast. You know,
Yeah, well,
I'm always going to be an East Coaster.
yeah. Well, is your whole family on the East Coast?
Almost all of it. I think the
Oh.
farthest west we go is Kentucky, of like the secondary level of like aunts, uncles, etc. Then there's more distant relatives. There's a branch of the family out in Washington, but beyond that, yeah, most of us are still in the same town we were born in.
Yeah, that's I think it's just who you it's the same exact thing as we were talking about with the feeling at home. I just this is associated with people, but I really love it. And Not to mention, Chicago is a pretty magical city as far as art goes, too. It's got some incredible museums, so I'm excited to visit their museum some more.
What are some of your favorite museums out there?
Oh my gosh. I only got a very brief amount of time in the Art Institute, and that's actually that and the Modern Art Museum. I'd really like to visit those two in depth because I only got a very brief amount of time as I was passing through in the fall. So it was like a tease, like, look at all the great things we have. Ha ha, you only have 10 minutes. So I kind of like to sit and look at things and think about them and sort of develop a response before flying to the next thing. So that's what I'm looking forward to, I think. But also, I want to go to, this is not a museum, but it's an attraction. When I was growing up, my favorite book was Girl of the Limberlost by Jean Stratton Porter, and she's an Indiana author. And Indiana is, the border is very close to Chicago. So I'm going to go to the place where she wrote and see the actual Limberlost. And it's like a pilgrimage from my youth. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I'm not familiar with that book.
It's Jean Stratton Porter herself was actually a naturalist. She wrote books about moths and plants and was a scientist. But she was one of the early, very, very educated women and respected in her field in 1918. And she wanted to see more women in the field of sciences. And so she wrote this book hoping to draw basically school-age girls into higher education and then on to becoming scientists. And I just found it really not just beautiful in the sense that, oh, here's this story, like a coming of age story about a girl who really discovers herself and then connects with a family that she didn't know she had, that she felt she'd lost access to. But also, I really love the natural world myself. And it just, the descriptions of the nature are beautiful. I think it's a very poetic book.
Did you want to go into sciences because of it?
No, because when I was in school, science in my mind was associated entirely with memorization. And I have a terrible memory. I'm really good at researching and I can remember attributes of something, but names of things, I have a very hard time remembering. And so even though I got good grades in science, it was always a really painful class for me because I struggled. And school was generally easy with me, except for the memorization part. So I don't think I ever even considered it.
So in your eyes, then, when people are like, oh, school is just about memorization and everything, and you're like, yeah, that's true and not.
Yeah, especially with the humanities, where if your memory is like mine, where you can remember big concepts or images, it's much easier to gravitate towards that field than it would be to, for instance, geometry. I couldn't remember the theorems and I couldn't remember anything important that I was being tested on. So I never thought I would go into math and I did not.
So your memory system is like, it can handle the big concepts, but not very small details?
I can even remember details, but it's just the names. For whatever reason, I can't latch on to, especially scientific Latin-y kinds of names. I'm okay at languages, so often I can kind of figure it out based on the roots that I know from French or Spanish that are Latinate. But if they're not related to the Romance languages, I have no idea what it's connected to.
Memory is such a strange thing.
It really is.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if I was talking to a scientist and they said, yeah, we still don't understand really anything about memory.
I don't know that they really do. But I think that as they do research on diseases like Alzheimer's, you know, and even diseases like Asperger's, I think they're going to start to draw connections between things that will open things up. I think this is a rapidly growing field.
I wouldn't doubt it. Memory is just so odd.
Well, I think that that's why I was drawn to being a librarian. And I do think that I am still, like, librarians are born, not made, because it's very comforting to know you can always look something up. You know, I really enjoyed that part of being a librarian. And actually, my whole bigger concepts, that really worked for book talks and the kids that would say, sorry, I can't remember the name of the book, but I can remember the color of the cover. I'd be like, oh, was it this one? Was it this one? Tell me about the story. And generally I could connect it, even though a lot of librarians complain about the, can you give me a book that had a black cover? I can't remember the name of it. But I found it a lot easier to remember that.
It's just almost like a detective mystery novel type moment.
Yeah, it is. I really love that aspect of it, like a treasure hunt too. You know, connecting the right book with the right kid was really fun.
You left the library system?
Yeah, I'm not a school librarian anymore. I put in my bio a lot of places that I'm a free range librarian. I offer book recommendations without being asked. But I'm no longer a school librarian now. It just became too bureaucratic for me, and I wasn't happy in my building, and it just kind of grew to something that used to be joyful and then became really kind of harrowing in a way.
It was time to move on, basically.
Yeah.
Move on.
It fed my creative life for sure. And I'm not sorry that I had, I mean, I spent about almost 15 years in various school libraries. So it was a solid thing I did.
And as you said, freelance in your own way still. So it's still part of you.
Oh yeah. I don't think you ever lose touch with that sort of experience.
Especially having that background has got to be so helpful when writing. I hate to bring in the whole writing process thing, but it's got to be a good skill to have.
Oh, it does. And also just the willingness to make serendipitous discoveries. You know, I'm rarely stuck because of it, where I can just kind of go to a shelf and at random pick something in my house, anything, or in the public library, and it spurs me on. I think that's something that librarianship gave me. So I'm grateful for that.
There's something wonderful about having an intense curiosity about things.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think that's one reason that people are so nostalgic about physical libraries is you're not just curious, but you're open to the next discovery. It's not something that you have to go looking for methodically online. You can just wander into the building and pull a book off the shelf.
And there's that that overwhelming sense of freedom that you can do this and it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just okay, it's encouraged. It's a huge, huge bonus to democracy, having public libraries.
I will not argue with that. I have many fond memories of not working, but going to a library as a kid was one of my favorite things my mom would do, just take me to the library.
Me too. And just dropping, at that time, grandma would just drop me off, like, go ahead, you know, swim free, little fishy. So I felt very, like, released from the everyday, you know, just to wander around like this wide open field. I loved it.
I still love it to a degree, even though I don't maybe not go to a physical library as much anymore, but databases, whew,
oh yeah,
just rate them.
People are becoming more, I mean, people, database designers are becoming more aware that that's something that people enjoy, that serendipity. So they'll have that like random page of a day or did you know kinds of sections so that you can encounter the information in a way that isn't necessarily methodical. You can just kind of wander in again. So I think that that's pretty magical too.
Yeah, I've got PDFs on my computer from databases. I'll never read them. I'll never use them, but they're mine.
Exactly. That might be why, though, physical books are even more satisfying still to me, because you can own them in such a way that, like, if your device crashes or if the rights holders on Amazon decide that things have changed, then they're going to strip them from your device on the next update. You can own a book, like the physical aspect of a book.
There's also a personal thing to it. Like, there are millions of copies of this Stephen King book, but this one is mine.
Exactly.
This is my copy.
I brought a book to a coffee that I was having with someone, and she picked it up off the table and she like started undog-earing all of my pages. And I was like, what are you doing? And I think she was just horrified that I would change the book. You know, in her mind, you don't treat a book this way. But in my mind, it's one of the like the glories of owning the book. You can do whatever you feel like to the book.
I tell my students that all the time about their textbooks. You bought the book. You own it. Write in it.
Yeah. One of the What felt like a very traumatic experience of my young adulthood was when my grandparents started cleaning out their storage in their, they have a garage attic, without asking me. My grandmother just basically gave away half of my college textbooks where I'd been storing them with them. I hadn't gotten them yet because I was living in a really small apartment and didn't even have very many bookshelves. But anyway, I had written in tons of them. And when I discovered this, I just was so upset because it felt like this conversation that I had with an author was just given away. Like, I mean, not just given away, but exposed. Like someone was going to read my thoughts to the author. It was upsetting.
Holy crap. I never thought about that. But yeah, I have a copy of one of my textbooks that is, I'm not kidding, held together by electrical tape and prayer at this point. Like the spine is completely gone, but it has all my notes and annotations in it. And I won't give it up because that's me talking back to the book going, what the hell are you talking about here?
Yeah. And I think that it starts to feel almost like a two-way diary where the diary has a persona, but you're still revealing a lot of yourself by the way that you interact with this thing. So I was really not happy with her, to say the least.
That's interesting you say that it reveals your personality. And I just had a brain flash. It's like, yeah, when I write a snarky joke in there, I wonder, that's like, I'm not taking you seriously anymore, author.
Yeah. Well, think about the, like, I think one of the reasons that people like to travel to places with graffiti is you get a sense of the actual individual who lives somewhere. Like there was a castle in Poland, back to Poland, but there was a castle there that Martin Luther had scrawled something on the wall. And I just felt like, oh my gosh, he was human. Like it's just sort of this epiphany, this historic figure who was two-dimensional until that moment became three-dimensional through his own little, like, putting a date on the wall. I don't know what it is about it. It's a real humanizing aspect to us, I think, or to the word.
No, I know what you're saying. We hear about like ancient Romans and everything, and then you find out about the graffiti at Pompeii or whatever, and it's the most vulgar things, you know, about anal sex and, you know, poop jokes, and you're like, these are the same as we are.
Right.
Humans.
Right. I mean, it happens over and over again too, where it's not enough to see it once, you know, you see it and every time it's kind of a magic minute where you are on the planet at the same time, almost as someone else. It makes you close. It feels good.
A couple thousand years. That's nothing in terms of geologic time. That's a microsecond.
Exactly.
Recently, I've read about the oldest known joke is a fart joke.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's the oldest one. It's like on a I want to say Babylonian, Sumerian, old tablet. And basically, it's that a wife does not fart in her husband's lap. It's like, that's the oldest known written joke. And it's a fart joke.
Of course it is. I mean, having worked with, you know, what now, close to, well, more than 1,000 young kids, you know, that is something that seems like instilled in them, you know?
Farts are funny. What can we say?
They're born with that knowledge.
Handed down from our species beginnings, farts are hilarious.
Right. What separates us from the monkeys? Fart jokes.
Fart jokes. There you go. That's it. We evolved to appreciate the fart joke.
Right.
There you go. We just discovered it. The reason for humanity's existence. The fart joke. There we go.
And I said I wasn't a scientist.
So I'm going to come back to say for a second here. You were in choir? I did not know this about you.
I was. I sang, let's see, second grade all the way through my undergraduate. I mean, and without a break. I was in every choir that I could get in. I joined it. I loved to sing. And it's funny because I was a really, really shy child. And I think that one of the reasons I wanted to do it was because it was safe. Like all the people around me were also singing and doing the thing they loved. And my voice just blended with theirs. I didn't have to stand out or do anything but sing with them. It just was a wonderful experience.
Created that connection without having to go out on the limb.
Right. And you can't talk when you're singing. Like, there's no pressure to make conversation. You know, it was really something that helped me through being a shy kid. I think that it really, beyond the opportunities it gave me to travel, because in the undergraduate choir, our group traveled a different direction each school year. And then the fourth year, fifth year, you traveled locally and then went to Europe. And I was one of those five-year college people who couldn't quite decide on their major. So I was in all five directions in the U.S. So I think on my last count, I've been to, I want to say 41 states was my final count. And we sang in all of them. So it just was this huge opportunity to see different parts of the U.S. and be with people who, like me, really loved music.
Totally awesome. Do you still sing?
No, I miss it. I think about it a lot, especially around holidays, because those are the, you know, the concert season. So every year I say to myself, oh, I'm going to volunteer, and not volunteer, but audition, because in this area, you know, you have to audition, but I chicken out. Oh, sorry. My dogs are playing. Stop, 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 stop. Sorry. The barking was about to start.
You could sense it.
I could, because they do this. They get to a state where they're having a good time, and then one of them basically says, all right, let's really play. And then the real racing around and chaos begins. They're good, so, but predictable.
You know their behavior at this point.
Yeah. I do.
How long have you had those dogs?
Well, the oldest of them I've had since, let's see, I've had him for 5 years. We adopted him when he was one. And the most recent one, we've just had him for one full year. We got him about this time last year, maybe a month ago. A month ago was his anniversary with us. And he was one when we got him also. So they're both Beagle Lab mixes. They're sweetie pies.
Oh, adorable.
But the first one, the older one, was my first dog. I grew up with cats, so I'm kind of ridiculous about him. I know I am.
You basically baby them a little bit, you know, spoil them.
A lot. I told my husband I basically ruined our black dog for anyone else. He's about almost 60 pounds, and he thinks he's a lap dog, so he crawls up on my lap in the recliner and just wants to lay on me. But he's definitely like a one-person dog.
Gravitates to you and just won't listen to anybody else, you know.
Yes, and he was super jealous of the second dog. I really was convinced he was lonely, because when we would go over to friends' houses who had dogs, he was so happy in the pack. I thought maybe he would want his own pack. But no, he really didn't.
But he's come to accept the other dog now?
Oh, yeah. As evidenced by the way he's sitting on him right now.
Oh, there's a pack, all right. He's just the alpha.
Right. He wants to make sure he knows this.
He wants a pack. He doesn't want part of a pack. He wants his own pack, you know?
Yes. And definitely, I think the main consternation was that, here's this interloper. Am I going to love him more? So he occasionally has to tell Benny that no, he's not really my dog. Toby is my dog.
That's interesting. Your first dog's name is Toby. That was my first dog.
Well, he came with that name. Toby did. And it never even occurred to me to change his name. Whereas every other pet I've owned, I've changed their name because I didn't like the one they arrived with, including Benny, actually.
I get that. I couldn't change my cat's name when I got him.
It doesn't matter if you change the cat's name, because they only respond to what they want to respond to.
That's kind of true, but he does know his name. Probably because we say it like 300 times a day. Half, get off the table. Half, no. Don't. Half.
I guess that's true. But Audrey, I changed her name, my cat. So she was Tigger. Tigger is a boy. Audrey is a girl. I wanted a different cat name.
Tigger's just such a common cat name, you know?
It is. And she, you know how Tigger is supposed to be, what, bouncy, trouncy, flouncy, pouncy, full of fun, fun, fun?
I'll take the word for
her. According to Disney. That was not Audrey. She was very demure and composed. She's not the kind of crazy cat in that way. She's a different kind of crazy.
I would have changed my cat's name, except that when I was adopting him, the shelter told me how he got the name. And so his name is Hef, short for Hefner, or full name Hugh Marston Hefner. Apparently he came to the shelter, he was not fixed at the time. He was too young for it, apparently.
Oh, no.
And so at a shelter, they keep the cats in isolation before they go into Gen Pop. But he had not been neutered. And apparently he broke out of the isolation area and was found with a whole bunch of lady cats just lying around him, like a harem. And once they told me that, I'm like, I'm keeping that name. I was going to change your name, but no, Hef is works for you then.
Yeah, I think there was he was aptly named then. Well, Benny was initially Bo, B-O was his name, but unfortunately, he arrived with such a confident attitude that it was too close to the word no when we were trying to tell him what not to do. That he wasn't responding to his name. We were saying no more often than Bo, and it just was, then when we would say Bo, it just was bad. So we decided to change it to Benny, both because the Elton John, like, it'd be funny to stand outside and just shout, Benny! Benny! But also then, he's got tons of allergies, so his full name is actually Benadryl.
Okay, that's adorable on so many levels.
He's a cutie pie. He really is.
Earlier you said something about, like, one of your things that this summer you're doing is scouting camps and retreats. Oh,
yes, not camps, but for Poet Camp. I started this thing called Poet Camp, which is the roving residency, mainly for women to go and both meet other artists and writers, but also to give them kind of material to work from. So I'm looking for specific exhibits or places that are inspiring that I can rent a house to take women to. So I'm excited about that.
Kind of like a retreat type of thing, but...
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it is also like a residency because there's enforced quiet time, but then there are also group activities. So... it is actually camp-like as far as my memories of summer camp or any camp where you had to be quiet at certain hours and you had to do the activities. But the activities are going to be more recommended than required. The only thing that I really require is the quiet time and also then that people take meals together because I think that that really promotes community and helps make connections. And at the end of each one that I've had so far, we've done a read around so that people can be familiar with each other's work and kind of make connections that way. But also residencies are so expensive both to apply to and many of them to attend that I try to keep the cost reasonable. And that's part of the scouting, trying to look for good locations because even houses can be expensive to rent.
How many of these have you done?
This will be my fourth. And I'm doing one in Frostburg that's sort of a 3.5 for the Indie Lit Festival with Sundress People. So I think that one's going to be fun. And that one's a co-ed one, which none of the other ones have been or probably won't be in the future. I think I'm just going to stick to women for the time being or, you know, female identified just because it's harder for some people who have fears about guys. So I don't want to scare people.
Totally understandable. We need that space.
Yeah. So I think that it's going to be good, but also it's kind of an opportunity for me to get to know people. I've met some really wonderful people through online writing groups, and it's been great hanging out with them. And they get a chance to get away from their home, so it's not like I'm descending on them, you know, but also to meet other people. I think it's been really fun. We've had the first one that I'm returning to is I haven't even set the date yet. I was actually hoping to do one in September, kind of between everything, up in Deep Creek, Maryland, that is close to the Frank Lloyd Wright attractions, but also on a lake. It's gorgeous. And we did that one last October, and it was phenomenal. So I'd like to return to that one. And it was really an ideal situation. So hopefully I can replicate the October one in September if the weather isn't too hot.
I was going to say, it's like October pretty much anywhere is awesome.
Yes, it's one of my favorite months. I really love winter, but October's heading right up the top 10 list.
Yeah, I'd put October probably as my favorite month of the year, just in terms of weather. I mean, coming from upstate New York, that was the perfect time. September, exactly. October, it was the golden time of the year.
Well, that's why October in Vermont just sounds idyllic to me. I'm really excited about that one. But even northern or, you know, upstate Maryland, the little handle thingy in the mountains, it was actually chilly. And so you got that sort of camp feeling. We had a campfire and we had, you know, like it felt very, what I remember of camp. Growing up, almost all of the summer camps I went to were either on the Finger Lakes or in New York or in New England. And so I associated camp with cool weather, even though it was in summertime.
The only difference now is that there's no enforced recreational activities, you know?
Right. Yes, it's not that kind of camp.
But everything else is there, you know, mealtime, campfires, quiet time, just no having to play canoe or arts and crafts, you know.
Exactly. Color wars.
Yeah. Things like whatever. I don't remember. I went to summer camp once and I hated it.
Oh, in my family, that was an activity. We did it almost every summer from, I think the first one was when I was 7 or 8, all the way up through high school. And all of them were Christian camps, so there were way more enforced activities than one might imagine for a leisure camp.
Wasn't just wallet making.
Right. There was chapel and things like that. So it was quite an experience. Not in a terrible way, but definitely not quite what I envisioned for poet camp.
And also maybe not what films give us in terms of the idea of going to summer camp.
No. I mean, some of it was, because we definitely did do the, you know, the Father Abraham had many sons with all the motions and everything like that. And all of our cabins had names. And there were pranks. And I mean, there, to a certain degree, it's just inflated ideas of summer camp is what film gives us, where the reality, the bugs, the bullying, the sorts of things that happen in school-aged children anyway, come right back out, and you're even being monitored by teenagers, not your parents. So sometimes it's worse than you would think. But I think it's such a thing in American imagination that it's a double-edged sword. It's both a good thing and a bad thing, the word camp.
Yeah, because I think of camp, and it's like my family had a camp on a lake. And it was wonderful. I spent many great years there, summers, and loved it. But the idea of summer camp and just having a bad experience at it, very double-edged, yeah.
I think that, I mean, growing up in the 80s and, you know, a little bit in the 70s, it was such a different time where, you know, summers were, if you were not in camp, you were just free, or I was freeform, like go ride your bike for 6 hours. I don't expect to see you till dinner time. You know, I basically just was kind of thrown into the wild. I mean, such as it was, like I said, the suburbs or the library. But then to go to camp and it be kind of like the worst parts of school as well as the best parts of school, where you had to socialize and I wasn't a social child. It was hard.
Yeah, you're right, is that there is the school aspects of it, except there's no like real learning involved. Like, oh, we don't have to take a test on social studies today.
When it's not like you're being managed by educators, you're, you know.
You're being managed by the guys who are beating you up in the hallway.
Right. Most people who worked at the camps were barely older than we were by high school. So it was different.
So it's like for poet camp, then you're taking the best aspects of camp, as you recall it, and trying to eliminate the scary stuff out of it, you know?
Exactly. I'm trying to reimagine camp in my life.
This is what camp should be.
Yes. But I think just as with anything, like I run a read around, like a seated workshop here in Northern Virginia, that really I'm just trying to put into the world something that I really want to participate in. You know, it's not, poet camp isn't like this huge, it's never going to be this prestigious thing. It's just going to be something that I hope writers enjoy going to, you know, and get something out of. And the same with this, the read around, where it's a mini workshop. We only have about 8 minutes per person to workshop, but you get to meet writers from the area and kind of ease that feeling of being alone as a writer. Because that's such a detrimental thing, I think, for me. I work better knowing that there are other people also working right now somewhere else doing the same thing.
And to know that the people you're working with or the people you know are cool.
Yeah, And I, like I said, being a shy child, I didn't really know how to maintain a social circle. Like I was so awkward and I felt different from every single other person. And so it's really great as a grown-up to not feel that way. You know, I think that it's one of the best things about being an adult.
There are a few distinct advantages, I'll grant you that, being an adult.
Yeah.
A few. There are some things I would like to take away and get rid of.
You know. Yeah, you know, bills, jobs.
Taxes, that sort of stuff, you know. The body getting older, you know, and knowing that gets to that point where you and your friends are no longer talking about things like, oh, so you've met this so-and-so, or you're getting married, and now it's, so I went to the doctor last week. Oh, really? What happened? Well, you know, my hip's been bothering me for 2 weeks. Just, I don't know. So, oh, so what meds are you on? Yeah, this one. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I had that a while ago.
Yeah, conversations have changed a lot.
As you get a, I'm starting to hit 40, and I'm like, I'm dreading what's going to start with my high school friends and I.
Yeah, I recently got back to swimming. I love swimming and going to the pool regularly. And I don't think I ever have been so aware of my shoulders. Like, they really ache. And I'm like, did I do this when I was a kid? I took swimming lessons. I have no memory of feeling this way. So it's just funny, these things that come up.
Worse are the ones where you wake up in the morning and you're like, that wasn't hurting when I went to bed. Why is it hurting now?
Yeah, there's a lot of tension in your dreams, apparently. I think this is why I'm so, like, I don't know, the whole idea of contests for under 30-year-olds, I'm like, please, they've got so much going for them. Like, this blissful unawareness of actual life, you know? It's not really fair. Like, can you please not give this to them too? Maybe let other people have a chance. I hate it.
I don't hate it. I can't say I hate it because I'm also mystified by how the body morphs on itself. Suddenly looking in the mirror and going, why do I have hair now growing out of my ear? I have to start shaving my ear side now.
I really am not one of those people who's like ashamed of my age or like fears, you know, oh my gosh, I'm approaching middle age or I am middle aged or like, I don't care. Really, I don't. I don't think I feel all that much difference as far as my personality or my thoughts or whatever than I did, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Like, your self is formed already, you know? So kind of exalting people who, you know, their life is in front of them, you know? It just, I don't understand it.
Aging gracefully.
I hope that's what I'm doing.
Your psychology is formed pretty early, and maybe it just refines itself as you get older. That's the only difference, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think I probably have mellowed. I hope I've mellowed. Maybe not think. Maybe I hope I mellowed. It's just something that I think about a lot, like the sort of skew that society has towards, you know, beautiful as defined in youth. It just is really something that is on my mind.
I've been thinking about it too recently because I'm finally reaching that point where I'm starting to go, man, I wish I was a teenager again. And I'm torn because then the next thought is, man, I'm glad I'm not a teenager anymore.
Exactly. That's why I'm like, I cannot remember ever thinking that thought. I wish I was a teenager again. My teenage years were not. They were fine. It's just there was a lot of hard stuff going on. And I mean, with my family. And then, you know, the usual high school, middle school angst, you know, all that stuff. I think I'm grateful for the friends that have come away from that. I have a friend who I've known since eighth grade. She's my oldest friend. And I appreciate her so much because we've seen basically our lives, you know, the entirety of our lives. And to have someone in your family of chosen people who's seen you from almost start to current is a pretty big gift. But other than that, I'm not all that nostalgic for going back.
Yeah, don't want to deal with the mentality of that age or the pressures of that. Screw all that.
Yeah.
It's like if you could go back in time and tell yourself anything, you know, tell your teenage self anything about the future, I'd be like, just survive this.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. Just survive. This too shall pass is what I think I would say. I'm not sure I would believe me, but I don't think I would say that.
No, I think the 16, 17-year-old me would freak out seeing the 37-year-old me walk in the room. You're me! You're you! It would be like, nobody ever mentions that aspect of traveling back in time to see the former selves as the freak out.
Oh, yeah. There's a really beautiful kids book called When You Reach Me by Rebecca Stead, which is incredible about time that has an aspect of time travel. And in reference to A Wrinkle in Time, it is amazing.
What's amazing about it? Or without, if you can tell me without giving it away.
I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
But it has a lot of amazing aspects. One, it has this way of telling the solo childhood. You know how they always have to be like orphans, or they always have to be, you know, abandoned at birth or whatever to get the kid alone to experience the thing. So the kids in this are not without their adults, but the adults are in a reasonable way absented from their story. But also the writing is poetic. The mode that she tells it in, if I'm recalling correctly, I'm trying to remember what game show. It's the mother is auditioning for the $25,000 pyramid. It's set in the 80s. I think it's $25,000 pyramid. So every title is, for instance, things that are made out of eggs. Or, I mean, that's a poor example. But you get the gist.
Mm-hmm.
So that was entertaining to me. But also the way that she slowly reveals the surprise that you have no awareness of. But then as soon as the surprise happens, you suddenly are – it's like the entire scene unfolds and you're like – holy moly, I have been traversing this painting at eye level, and then I draw back, and it's this, you know, masterpiece. It just was so, so well done.
What book was that?
When You Reach Me.
I might have to look into that, maybe put it on a list of summer reading.
It's short, but it's just, it's really well done. And it's, I'm trying to think of the age group, say fifth or sixth grade reading level or reading. The audience for this book is meant to be fifth or sixth graders, but it's one of those books that has huge appeal to me as a grown up. I loved it.
I hate the idea of aging things because as an adult, I don't consider it childish if I want to read a young adult novel.
No, same here. And I'm a rereader. So for the last, I think, nine or 10 years, I've read every single winter. I read the entire Chronicles of Narnia. At Christmas time, I read Little Women. I mean, I reread methodically. I like to revisit the books from my childhood. Every summer, I read Anne of Green Gables, the whole series. And I would tell the kids when I was a librarian that this is the kind of book that you probably will revisit. Because as a grown-up, you see things that the kids don't, of course, which is why censorship is so ridiculous, because you're not reading with a kid's mentality. You know, a child was never harmed by a book, by reading something that was, quote, inappropriate. They just gloss over it. They don't have the background knowledge. So I told them that about a couple of different books, and I didn't use that as kind of a whap you over the head kind of recommendation. I just would tell them that there were several books that even as a grown-up, sometimes I would say, I wish I first read this when I was your age so that I would always have it with me and in my mind to revisit. But now I'm going to revisit it every year. But sometimes I would say, this is a book that I have reread. Kids are so receptive to that kind of information. They want to know what you find comforting. I recommended a lot of books like that.
If I can add mine to the list, you've got a few that you mentioned there, Little Women, Anne of Green Gables. Me, every few years, I go, during the summer, I'll reread the entire Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series.
Yeah.
It's just something comfortable to me.
What a loss. I'm doing that with Terry Pratchett right now. Like, I feel like we're losing these giants, but of course you do. Like, in life, you know, and people are always dying, you know, like you said before. But I don't think either of these people are going to be forgotten. You know, Douglas Adams was such a pillar of the writing canon. I don't think he's going to be forgotten. And I feel the same way about Terry Pratchett's books. I think people are going to have a growing appreciation for what he was writing about, as opposed to fading into history.
No surprise with my mentality that I love Death and the Mort series in there. I haven't read many of Pratchett's. I've read like three of them. They all are the Death ones, but I've enjoyed them.
Well, he appears in many, many of them. I like the Granny Weatherwax figure. I read the Witches ones over and over and over again. And Tiffany Aching, that set in particular, I've read. And I listened to them on audiobook also. So it's been a new addition to my rereading.
I also recommend, if you haven't seen them, the cartoons with Christopher Lee as Death.
Yeah, I've seen just about everything that's out there. Have you seen, I mean, as far as Terry Pratchett goes, have you seen Going Postal?
No.
Oh, my goodness. So if you can bear to veer away from Death for a minute, watch Going Postal. Hogfather has Death in it a little bit because it has Susan, Death's granddaughter, as one of the main characters. But Going Postal is something that I think it's one of the best things the BBC ever put out there. And that's saying a lot.
Well, we can talk about the BBC's programming another time, because I'm looking at the clock and every time I talk with you, Sarah, it feels like time just flies by with you.
Yes, I feel the same way, Scotty.
You are so much fun to talk to, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Before we let you off the hook, though, and let you go, though, today, where can the folks find you online? They want to find information about your work, about Poetry Camp, etc.
Okay, so my personal website is bluebirdwords.com. That one I can't even explain. I just really like those words together, being about bluebirdwords.com. Poet Camp has its own website, poetcamp.com, and people can join the list, and I can send them information about upcoming camps and things like that. I have two chapbooks coming out this summer. Pork Belly has Haunting the Last House on Holland Island, which is due out, I believe, the end of June. And Essay Press is coming early September out with Field Guide to Alma Avenue and Fru Drive as an ebook, and that'll be free. So people can get that hybrid science-y influence stuff there. But I'm also on Twitter and all different places under Sarah Ann Wynn. So I hope people hunt me down.
Kick ass. Well, I will keep an eye out for your chapbooks coming out, because I once joked to you that I want everything you've ever written. Oh, and I think that still holds true.
I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you being on here today, Sarah. It is truly awesome to have you, and feel free to come back anytime on this program.
Thanks. I'll take you up on that. This has been so much fun, Scott.
Oh, indeed. It's always fun to have you on the program. We'll talk to you soon, though. Enjoy your summer here as it begins.
You too. Have a great day.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.